Okay.
Hello, welcome to this NZDS OS chat. This morning with funeral director and embalmer Brenton Faithful from New Zealand. So before we start, we just have to make the inevitable disclaimers. I'm a doctor, but I'm not currently working as a doctor, so I do not seek to diagnose or treat any illnesses during our talk today. My opinions are my own, based on now many thousands of hours of research and investigation since I stopped working. For information on COVID-19 and vaccinations, please see the New Zealand Ministry of Health website. So let's dive straight in. I'm delighted this morning to talk to Brenton Faithful, who has a lifetime of experience as a funeral director and embalmer. And it's particularly pertinent that we're talking this week, because here in New Zealand, submissions are open on proposals to change the Coroner's Act here in ways that actually we think are quite alarming. There is already a relative epidemic of deaths in particularly younger people that are really defying all statistics that go back certainly to the pre-COVID era. And in some jurisdictions now around the world, unexplained death is now the commonest cause of death. And the New Zealand government is proposing to further remove the surveillance and the kind of community sentinel effect that the coroners are supposed to carry out by proposing a level of coroner's sort of assistant or administrator who will have the power to issue death certificates and to sign off on deaths, even when there's not a clear cause of death, and perhaps even without post-mortem or certainly an inquiry or an inquest. And we think this is very, very alarming at a time when, more and more deaths require explanation. And there is, of course, the very large elephant in the room possibility of what might be behind this supposedly unexplained surge in all-cause mortality in deaths in all age groups. And it's particularly tragic and worrying in the young, who typically are expected to live their long healthy lifespan. So let's get right in. Brenton, welcome. I wonder if you would just explain to us, a little background of who you are, what you do, and what you've noticed in terms of changes in your professional life.
Thanks, Matt. I'm delighted to be able to speak. Brenton Faithful is my name. Almost 41 years as a funeral director in Bama. I'm my own business and have done for the last 26 years. It has been quite alarming. What your introduction alludes to is a number of anomalies that I've noticed in the last 2.5 years, especially during lockdowns and death certificates and families with very cruel measures being put in place with regards to meetings and arrangements. One of the things before I start is one of the ironic things in New Zealand law is if someone is to be buried, then a doctor actually doesn't even need to cite a patient after death. It's just they can write a certificate out. In fact, it's all done online now. 99% of the doctors will do certificates online. During the COVID lockdowns, it was sometimes the identification of the patient was actually done by a Zoom meeting or using a phone, using an app for identifying the body. Now, who confirms the patient is dead? Under the emergency management rules, it can be a trusted person. Now, that trusted person isn't defined in law of who that person is. So in chatting with a doctor called a medical referee, he's the doctor that oversees the doctor's patients when someone is cremated. So when someone's cremated, the patient has to be identified by the doctor. Now that was done many occasions via a Zoom meeting, and the responsibility of the person being deceased was left to a trusted person. The referee indicated that could be me, that could be anybody. There's no definition. It could be a nurse, it could be a policeman, We do have training. One of the things before we prepare a body for funeralization, for burial or cremation, is that we do check that the person is dead. I mean, a lot of fears have been brought about over the centuries about being buried alive, and I can understand why some people have those fears, but the funeral director is a person who will ensure that, that your basically life is extinct. So we're the doctors absent to do that. Now, some of the things I've noticed as well, and I will draw attention to the UK funeral director, who I'm seen two or three times on social media, John O'Looney, suffered some difficult things from his association that he belonged to as well. When he spoke out, I think he was censored, but he still continued to speak out. Now, I've watched adverse effects through patients as well who have, it's very obvious they've died within 2 weeks of receiving the vaccination. And a lot of them almost appear to die of anaphylaxis, you know, it's almost a reaction straight away to the person. So die same day, the following day after receiving the COVID-19 vaccination. Now, this isn't a one-off case. This is the majority of cases that have come through our facility as well. So it's not a question we would normally ask the family. It's private information whether someone's been vaccinated or not. But often that information has been freely given to us as well. So we, you know, the families will say, well, Dad had a vaccine 2 days ago. Do you think that might have contributed? Well, I've indicated that people perhaps should speak to the doctor, speak to their GP, and even report it to the various institutions, CALM and VAERS, who hold the statistics of adverse effects, who are collating the information. There's been a huge reluctance to do that. One family only has said, yes, I'd like to take it further. So we tried to get a coroner involved. The doctor had signed off the certificate as to cause of death. He had insisted that his father not be vaccinated. And his sister, who was a registered nurse, said, Dad, you need to get vaccinated. So he conceded, took the vaccine. 4 days later, he was dead. Now, the son who didn't want Dad vaccinated tried to get a post-mortem done through the coroner. The coroner wasn't interested. So he tried private pathologists, but there is a shortage of pathologists in New Zealand as well right now, so a worldwide shortage of pathologists, really. And we just couldn't get one to, so he ended up doing an affidavit, I think, to the police. He's expressed, you know, huge concerns that the vaccine did cause his father's death. But up till recent times, we haven't seen the coroner provide any findings of the vaccine reactions causing death until recently. Now, this is what drew my attention to contacting you, Matt, as well, because I'm aware the submissions do close fairly soon. And, you know, I want to provide evidence that the coroner is one of the significant people in the country whom we respect and look up to, but trying to allow coroners not to allow this information to become public is detrimental, I think, to society. So that's where I'm coming from as an individual and as a funeral director on behalf of the families that we serve as well. So it's very concerning to me that they're trying to suppress the coroner.
Thank you very much, Brenton. Have you been keeping any of your own sort of formal, you know, statistics or numbers? Because one of the responses, in fact, one of the very few, I think the only response actually we've ever had from our drug regulator here, MedSafe, to the lists of names of people that have died very close to vaccination that we've been providing regularly since September last year, is that, well, of course, just by sheer coincidence, you know, people will die close to their vaccination because so many people were being vaccinated, and particularly the older people over 60, 65, I think it was right at the beginning. Gosh, it seems such a long time ago. I can't remember. So, you know, this is why we think we're seeing deaths proximate to vaccination when in fact it's just our own, you know, selection bias, and people die all the time. And I mean, we know that. And many of us have been GPs all our lives and working in the communities. So, you know, we're used to the patterns of death and what people die from and who dies, frankly. And it's, you know, the younger you get, the rarer it is to actually die. I mean, you're never less likely in your life to die than about 11 or 12 years of age. And yet there have been some very distressing, you know, cases in the last year or two of exactly that. So do you have a sense of numbers and you know, who was vaccinated and who wasn't with the clients that you've been seeing since, well, certainly during COVID and then with the rollout?
I started counting in August last year, 2021. That's when I started keeping statistics because families were saying to me, Dad suddenly died. We're not sure. I would ask, has he been vaccinated? Has he received a booster? Yes, he was just got it yesterday. You know, so I said, well, do you think there's any drawn conclusion that the vaccine may have contributed to his death? Well, we don't know. I said, was he well yesterday? Was he well prior? Oh, you know, absolutely fine. So the only ones who haven't seemed to have died within 2 weeks are the people who have chosen not to be vaccinated, of course, or have a terminal illness, and the family felt, look, getting the vaccine isn't going to do anything. Mum's terminal; she's on palliative care. It seems a pointless exercise. So by far, the majority of cases that we've looked after have died. So. It's not a question that we ask, was mum vaccinated or boosted? It's often something that's offered to me from the family. As a funeral director, people do share with you very confidential information at times. You know, it's closer, you'd hear more about the person than anyone else that would step through the front door at times. There's information that we need to register a person's death. We liaise with the doctor. Now, sadly, I must say the doctors on occasion may ask, what do you think the person died from? Well, probably what they're trying to say is, what did the family say to you with regards to the symptoms that the person had prior to their death? You know, how long it's... The doctor must know why the person died in order to write a certificate out. It's not beyond reasonable. They must know what the patient died from. But sometimes it's a little bit difficult contacting the family when they're in grief. So we're the point of go between at times. So the information that's shared to me by the family, I'm going to happily share with the doctor. But it has been a huge concern to me, the number of people that have passed away as a result of being vaccinated. It's almost like, as I mentioned earlier, anaphylaxis. It's almost like the body is reacting immediately to the vaccine or within a few days. So my understanding is in New Zealand rules that someone is not vaccinated until 2 weeks have elapsed as well, having received both doses in New Zealand and the approved vaccines in New Zealand. So that's a very broad definition of unvaccinated. So I guess figures could be manipulated. Figures from the Ministry of Health could be changed in all sorts of ways. Often yeah. I've seen the rules change about how they record things. It's a learning experience for everybody, but you know, it's adverse as far as I can see.
Yeah, look, Brenton, that's certainly something we've been banging on about is the what's almost seems like a deliberate misclassification of you know, who's vaccinated and unvaccinated. You know, from a safety or a side effect perspective, really, the moment the needle goes in the arm, somebody should be considered vaccinated, and they should be you know, watched, as in fact was promised would happen before the vaccine rollout. We were told that everybody vaccinated would be followed up, whereas it turns out that in some of the studies that supposedly show that you know, you're less likely to have a serious outcome with the shots. You know, the definition, as you say, was twisted. You know, you weren't considered vaccinated until maybe even after your second shot. Or in the case of Sweden, which was turned up by an OIA request that was made by some doctors and journalists, they acknowledged that you'd be vaccinated for 2 weeks after the first jab, and then you'd have the second jab, and then you'd be considered unvaccinated again for another 2 weeks. You know, and that's a recognition that you're more likely to catch COVID just after you've been received, a jab. So if you wanted to, you know, hide or distort, trivialize, what was going on, that would be a way to do it. Now, in fact, if you change the definitions and you just use from the moment the needle goes in the first time as then meaning somebody's vaccinated, the statistics actually flip. They really do. So we've been told, over and over that vaccination protects you from serious outcomes. But looking at the government's own figures itself, that's just, not correct. So I just want to go back and ask you again, maybe push you a little bit on the numbers, because I'm sure you guys keep good records. You're obviously not automatically privy to, you can't check on somebody's vaccine status. But as you say, relatives talk to you, and presumably you do have some, do you get medical information that comes in? And are you able to kind of quantify, how many of your clients that you were seeing, had died reasonably recently after a vaccination?
It's an interesting question, Matt. When I started counting in the August of last year, it was one after the other, after the other, after the other. And when I got to 20, it was 19 who had died within 2 weeks. So carrying on from 20, so the first 20 deaths, I counted 19 of them. So it's 95%. The next number, it was 100% of the people who died had been vaccinated within 2. So it depends when the booster has come out, the first and the second vaccine has come out, and then the booster, it'll go in a wave. So we get 100% and it'll drop to 90%. So I've gathered the statistics, it's 95% of the people who have passed away through the work that I've done has been vaccinated within 2 weeks.
Gosh.
95%.
Look, I mean, that's just one person's experience, but there are certainly other fairly high profile funeral directors and embalmers from overseas. And you mentioned John O'Looney, I think, and certainly a guy called Richard Hirschman in the States. He's done a lot of work around this. And he's talked particularly about the clots that he's extracting, as has John O'Looney, that they're seeing a type of clot and just how often and how extensive some of these clots are that are different from anything that they'd ever seen in their long, extensive working lives before the vaccination campaign and things. Have you found anything similar yourself?
Yes. So the trend of viewing a deceased has, I've noticed a change. There's less people viewing, there's more people having what's called a direct cremation. And in that case, the person isn't embalmed. There's no ceremony. They just put them in a casket and take them to the crematorium, and the family may celebrate later on. So the percentage of people having direct cremations is increasing. Therefore, the amount of embalming we're doing is less. Now, when someone chooses to have a funeral with a viewing, then by far the majority of cases are embalmed. Now, when someone's embalmed, the process is that the body fluids are removed and replaced by a preserver. The other way around, the preserver is put in and then the body fluids come out. So what we do when we're training is we learn a lot about clots, the clotting factors, coagula initially, then clots. And blood will form a clot over time, whether it's inside a vessel or exposed to the air. Some of them are there prior to death, and some of them are there occur after death. Now, there's different types of clots that we notice, but the one that's appeared over the last 2 years is very unusual. It's not one that I've seen before, and it's common in people who have been vaccinated as well. I'm not seeing it in people are unvaccinated, but it's there in people. It's very difficult to describe. It's white. What I've observed is a white clot, probably about an inch long, between inch and an inch and a half, or 25 millimetres to 35 millimetres long, almost rubbery, almost. But it's a difficult dilemma, an ethical dilemma about whether we keep these samples. You know, we'd have to ask permission to keep these so I don't have any in evidence. But if the family gives me permission to maintain a tissue sample, I would do so, but I haven't asked a family member yet. May we keep some tissue samples? It's a dilemma that we would have. So I can't provide the evidence to you now in photographs because, again, we need the family's permission. So it's just an observation that I've made.
Yeah, look, I understand that entirely. And actually, talking about evidence, you have another side to your life, don't you? Is that which I just bring up because it means that we can take what you say even more seriously, because you understand the import of not telling the truth, the importance of evidence and things. Is that something that you want to tell us a little bit about at the moment?
In terms of being a justice of the peace?
Yes, yeah. So you have a legal standing and a bit of legal knowledge, don't you?
Yes. So I was approached by a health professional who wanted to observe the contents of a vaccine. Actually, he managed to acquire a vaccine and looked under an optical microscope at it. And I was there as a justice of the peace, I guess, to witness what he determined and what he found. And his findings have been published as well. So there was significant things in the vaccine that aren't in the material safety data sheets of the vaccine as well. So he's come to the conclusion of that. So I've observed things that are in the vaccine that are not stated that are in the vaccine.
So you were there in a legal capacity to ensure there was no mucking around or fraud?
Correct. Yes.
In your capacity as a justice of the police?
It's not something normal. Normally, we would just witness affidavits or, we're sworn in by the court to uphold the law. We're sworn in to statutory declarations, affidavits, witness affidavits, as well as certified copies of documents. So that's extended beyond the call of duty, really, as a justice of the peace. But I thought a credible witness would be in order. So I went along with a justice hat on to witness, basically a witness and affidavit was provided by the health professional.
Right. So, I mean, you're certainly not pulling our leg with all this stuff.
No, not at all. No. When I was sticking my neck out, I'm aware that nobody else in New Zealand as a funeral professional has spoken out like I have, so it could be detrimental to my business. I don't know. I'm hoping not. I'm hoping people will realise that there is something in the vaccine. It's just not, I'm not out here for an ego trip or seek glory or anything like that. Far from it. What I want to do is just, share my experiences. And I believe it's necessary to do so.
Yeah. And thank you very much for doing that, Brenton. We all understand, it's not easy, and yet, in some ways it's the easiest thing we've ever done in terms of telling the truth as we see it. It's important to remember that we're all, we're all subject to all sorts of biases and, supposed scientists don't seem necessarily any more protected from falling into the same traps, as the rest of us. But you provide a very important part of the jigsaw of evidence, if we can think of it like that. In terms of the numbers and the physical changes that are happening in the bodies of people that may be leading to their sudden and unexplained deaths. So can I ask, do you think you have seen any changes in the sort of distribution of ages of clients that you're dealing with? And I don't mean to give a leading question, and I don't know what you're going to say, but it's certainly something that other people have touched on. And John O'Looney, I think, talks a lot about, babies and how he's seeing that his local hospitals are now dealing more and more with stillbirths or early neonatal deaths or very, very late miscarriages, much more in-house. And that less of that work is being done by the funeral directors. And he's worried by that and wonders why that is. But have you, have you noticed any changes? And I guess what I'm asking is, have you seen younger people coming through in a way that you wouldn't have done before?
In answer to that, no, I haven't. Although there have been people in their 40s and 50s who normally would not have passed away. We haven't had a high incidence of infant mortality. So what John alluded, could be alluded to is correct. They're bypassing the funeral homes. I'm just one of 250 funeral homes in New Zealand. And I do hope that this will allow other colleagues to speak out as well with their experiences as well. But in terms of me personally, younger yes, I'm hearing of it, but that's not experienced by me personally. So
okay, thank you. How many how many clients do you see? Are you a busy funeral director?
Yes, we are a busy funeral director. I mean, we'd be the average sized funeral home in New Zealand. I mean, we speak of case numbers in terms of being busy or not. So we'd be considered a medium average size firm.
So okay, and you would normally notice the same sort of seasonal flow that we would, you know, working as doctors in the community, in terms of much busier in winter than summer.
When I first started as a funeral director, it was definitely a winter summer scenario. There were people who basically the financial year starts on the 1st of April, and that next 6 months is a very, very busy time, and then it leans out in the summer months. So the annual funeral directors conference is held in February, in summer, when it's quiet. So with the advent of nursing homes, rest homes, the graph of the peak in winter diminished down because they weren't experiencing the cold. They just turned the heaters up in those places. But the respiratory illnesses, which predominate through winter, you know, certainly aren't there in summertime. So the flus and the colds and pneumonia, we're not seeing in summertime. It's their winter. So there is still a peak that occurs during the winter months, but it's not as noticeable as when I first began the career. But definitely.
Okay, and this last summer that we had, was that, you know, did that continue that pattern? Or do you think you were more?
It was an unusual year. The first year of lockdown, 2020, was an unusual year because nobody died of influenza. Normally, there's a 600 odd people die each year of influenza, and nobody in 2020 died of influenza, to my knowledge. 2021, the winter number of respiratory illnesses grew, and this year it's growing more. I think the rolling death rate, when I last observed, was around 10% more than it was last year. So every death that's registered, every birth that's registered, gets a sequential number. So that's the easy way for us to find out how the year is progressing in comparison to last year. We just look at the sequential number of the death certificates that we received back from the Registrar of Births, Deaths and Marriages. And we can see, so this year, it appears to be about 10% higher than it was last year. But in terms of number of deaths, 33,000 on average. You know, we're probably going to aim for 36,000 by the look of it, 37,000 for this year, calendar year. So there are more deaths this year. Perhaps it's the law of averages. There weren't so many deaths in 2020, and people have just lived a little bit longer. But the death rate, the number of people who die in a given community, there is a statistic. And when I first started, it was 8 people per 1,000 per year would die. Because we're living longer, the medicine is keeping us alive longer, 7.1 people will die per 1,000 per year at the moment. It's just a phenomenon living in the Western world. I can't say that it's the same in other countries, but people are living longer.
Well, I think it is relatively consistent as far as our work and research is.
The Western world, I think.
It's between about 0.8 and 1%, isn't it? In any developed country, will die per year. So that fits nicely with what you said, and of course we know because we've been following it that there's a very alarming and very consistent rise in all-cause mortality in certainly the heavily vaccinated countries. There's a uniform consistency that is alarming, and again, what sticks out like a sore thumb is the younger ages, the working age adults. Teenagers as well, because it's so rare for younger people to die, especially children, that it's very noticeable when that ticks up. So That's been very, very, very interesting information, Brenton. Can I just pin you down a little bit, though, if you don't mind? You're confident, are you, that from what you hear, that the factor that in common is more a recent vaccination rather than them actually dying of COVID?
Yes. People die with COVID. People have died of COVID. I'm I guess, quite fortunate. I consider myself having a good immunity system. I've not actually caught COVID to this point, yet we're dealing with dozens and dozens of people who have been COVID positive or died with COVID. So
on the death certificates, which you obviously see,
two people in the last 6 weeks have had COVID on the death certificate. Prior to that, COVID wasn't mentioned at all on the death certificate.
So, right, so not even with COVID?
Not even with COVID, no.
Okay. Have you seen many where the death certificate is just unequivocal, you know, cause of death, COVID-19?
No.
Okay. All right. And do you think you're still seeing that proportion of clients come through who've had a vaccine within a couple of weeks?
Well, I know that from statistics that people are still receiving their boosters, that the number of boosters that have been given is less than the first and second vaccines. I stopped counting when I got to a certain statistic because I'm thinking, well, whilst the boosters now are less, we're not seeing the same amount right now. So I stopped counting a month ago. So that's in terms of my statistics, that was up until a month ago.
Okay. August to August. Okay. So while you've been counting, what did the percentage come out at? You thought it was a very recent vaccination?
95%.
95%.
We're at the height of the second booster, the second vaccine and the first and second boosters.
And in terms of how busy you were, you know, the waves, the sort of ebb and flow that we all recognize, you know, happens when we work in health, or even the, you know, the very sort of specific area of health or lack of it that you work in, you know, we're well used to sometimes just inexplicable quiet times and busy times. But you know, do you think you've noticed a correlation with what's going on with the vaccine campaign and you know, who's getting it and when?
We've been constantly busy. It hasn't slowed. We've been constantly busy. So it's all modes and methods of death as well. Someone has to die of a particular condition or a process. So you've got to die of something due to something else. So dying of old age, for instance, isn't a recognised cause of death. And it's something a lot of doctors had been putting on certificates as well prior to, I guess, learning. I understand at medical school, there's not a lot of time spent on how to fill out a death certificate. So new doctors, often we get asked to help them.
You definitely learn it on the job. And as you say, you know, a lot of people, as we would wish for people, actually, you know, just get worn out and die at around their sort of 83, 84, I think is the the sort of average age of death. And the usual final mechanism is an infection or something. You know, the immune system ages along with us, and you know, a passing cough or cold bug or something that we would have thrown off easily when we were younger. You know, in the end, we just don't deal with it. And so the people that die of, or rather who don't die of heart disease or cancer or strokes, or perhaps dementia, and usually that's a nutrition issue, really, you know, do actually just stay fairly hale and hearty and then just die fairly quickly over, you know, a few days or something like that. You know, and yet, as you say, we're not allowed to write down, you know, just died of old age. But like many things since the era of COVID, the rules that we ran by have been upended and changed very quickly, to the extent, I think, as you inferred, that you know, you don't even need a doctor to certify death anymore. And that, you know, often there's just a best guess going on. And something that's alarmed us very much are stories coming from, you know, the families around their interactions with coroners, and coroners talking to doctors and things. And often they're just sort of plucking straws. You know, there's a best guess scenario going on, when plainly there ought to be a post-mortem, if not an investigation. But as you inferred, there was already a shortage of pathologists and, in fact, coroners. And one of our problems in New Zealand, uniquely, well, compared to, say, the UK, where you can either doctors or lawyers can be coroners, whereas here it's just lawyers. And, you know, it's not necessarily fair to expect a lawyer to be, you know, alert or to notice sudden changes in the patterns of, you know, who is dying of what and when in the community, because, you know, we say that there has been a significant change, and it's, you know, it's one of the many alarm bells. And I'd like to thank you for your contribution and your bravery, certainly. I do know of one or two other people in your position, actually, who are starting to talk out and give local talks and things. So you're not entirely on your own. How many of you are there in New Zealand, funeral directors?
There's probably about 800 individuals, 250 firms, I would say, is a guess.
So is there a professional organisation or, you know, the director of the body?
There are several organisations that people can belong to. You can choose one or the other or none at all. So
it's not compulsory. So you can't be dictated to in terms of,
yes,
you know, your how you present yourself and what you say.
Correct. Yes.
Well, that's good to know, because I'd hate to think you're going to get in trouble for coming and talking to us.
I hope not. I just hope people see sense. The coroner service is overworked. Just going back to what we had, there used to be 92 coroners in New Zealand. Each small town, because they had one, then the Coroner's Act changed and they centralised everything. I think there's 15 or 17 coroners now throughout New Zealand. So one coroner's on call for the whole of the country at any given time through the evening. So they provide a very good service, the coroner's service, absolutely. But I think
of course they do. And it's absolutely essential for the community, actually, that they are on the watch for... Well, it's, you know, it's more than 1,000 years old, I think, that role. And you know, through the ages, their most important job has been, you know, spotting or quantifying, you know, plagues and pestilence, you know, infectious disease waves, you know, criminality, poisoning, neglect, deprivation.
Yes.
You know, they're very important. You know,
very important. No, what I was alluding to was the expediency in which we receive a body back from the coroners when a person dies suddenly. They're taken into the coroner's care. You know, the coroner has possession of the body. They own that body until they've satisfied that there's no further examination required, and then they'll release the body back to the family. So as an agent for the family, we can go and collect the body. So the communication is very good between the coroner and ourselves. So that's certainly improved with the new Coroner's Act. But what concerns me now is the changes the government are looking at putting through.
It's
going to be very detrimental.
Yeah, and I mean, in the preamble, the excuse or the explanation for the changes that are proposed, you know, is the acknowledgement that coroners are overworked, there aren't enough of them, and that they want to be able to free them up so that they can work more quickly on more complex cases, and we'd certainly support that on the face of it. But if it means that you know, many, you know, deaths of unknown cause, and in particular in younger patients, where, you know, we should be demanding an explanation as to what is carrying off our people before their time, then really they should be putting money into, you know, supplying more coroners and supporting their work. Rather than delegating and diminishing the importance of the work they do, in what, you know, you can make a very easy case that potentially this could be swept under the carpet by accident or design. You know, it's certainly a possibility that would be built into watering down the Coroner's Act. And you know, I've certainly had plenty of cases in my professional career where you know, the coroner and I would agree that, you know, ideally a post-mortem would be, you know, desirable, but it's not essential. And if the family, you know, don't want one, or if the pathologists are really busy, then, you know, we do make a best guess. And certainly as doctors, we know our patients well. And you know, we can be trusted to be alert to, you know, something unexpected or, you know, left field that would, you know, trigger our alarm bells and demand an investigation, so that everything's, you know, signed off properly and explained. And we worry certainly that there'll be more opportunities for, you know, lack of clarity and for families to be left, you know, for the rest of their days, you know, just wondering what might have happened. And we do have a shortage of pathologists too, able to do autopsies and postmortems. And one of the problems we've identified, and from having spoken to pathologists, is that they too are doctors and they're regulated also by the medical council, you know, who've been very, very strong on you know, suppressing any counter narrative, you know, information that might undermine the whole safe and effective thing. And I'm sure some pathologists will be acutely aware of that. And not only that, but it can be very painstaking and require very specific testing, and maybe lots of slides to, you know, reliably prove the sort of the pathology of you know, a reaction to a medication. And you know, we just worry that there isn't the you know, the funding or perhaps even the political support for those sort of activities. And obviously you're the sort of the, you know, you're below the ambulance at the bottom of the cliff. You're even underneath the ambulance. But
I know from years ago,
what you see is very, very important.
Decades ago, we wouldn't have a release of the body back to us until the investigation had been complete. And in some cases, samples were sent to the UK for analysis, histology. We didn't have the ability to do it here. We didn't have the technology. But the mortuary at Auckland Hospital has got CAT scanning equipment now, so they can actually scan the body prior to a post-mortem. So in a lot of cases, a post-mortem isn't held because the CAT scan can, or the MRI scan can determine what may have been the problem without having to dissect the body as well.
So, yeah, it's called an external post-mortem, isn't it, I think?
Mm, yes.
Yeah. Yes. Okay, all right. Well, look, I think we covered a lot of ground, and I'm very grateful for your time and your candor and courage. And I think I don't think you'll be alone. You know, I am aware that you know, there are some other people in your position who hopefully will corroborate. Hopefully they won't. Actually, you know, the idea would be that what you're seeing is an outlier and that everything's fine. But you know, as critical and intelligent people, that's not good enough for us, is it? You know, we have to deal with the facts as they come in.
If we are experiencing it, then so must others be as well. We can't be unique. So
yeah. Okay. All right. Well, look, we'll leave it there, and perhaps we'll catch up with you another time. But thank you very much, Brenton. We appreciate it.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Okay. See you again.
Bye bye.